Good evening. I represent consumers of Clark County.
Thank you. Okay. John Kaley, are you with us today? Don't see Joan yet. Hopefully she'll join us. Paul Childers? Well, I'll swing back around if I see him pop in. Mark Collier.
I think you're muted, Mark.
Oh, you're muted. We can't hear you.
There you go.
Representative Septic Installers, Maintenance Specialist, and Septic Designers.
Thank you very much, Mark. Remy Eusen.
Representing the dental community.
Thank you. Adrian Fairbanks, I see your name.
Hi, guys. Sorry. I'm not driving. I am waiting to drive home from work. But I'm Adrian Fairbanks, and I represent the veterinary medicine group. I'm a veterinarian.
Thank you, Adrian. And Dave Fuller.
Good evening. I'm with Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency and representing emergency management.
Thank you. I'm hearing some feedback, I think, and I'm not sure if I'm the only one hearing that.
I think that's Mark. Hey, Mark. Mark, can you mute your phone, please? Thank you.
Okay, very good. And then Katie.
Hi, I'm Katie, and I represent the Youth Voice of Clark County.
Thank you. Katie will be with us hopefully at our next meeting in June, and then she's graduating, so I think she's going to be handing the baton, and we're really excited for you, Katie. And Dr. Lawrence Neville.
Hi, sorry, I took a bite of food at the wrong time. Lawrence Neville, I'm a neurologist, and serve as chief medical officer for PeaceHealth. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Let's see, Stephanie Rosie Yamashita. I don't see her, so we'll see if she pops in later. John Roth. Okay, and I'm Marla Sanger, and then Cassie. Don't see Cassie, but I do see you, Aru. Would you please state what organization you're representing and your role with the faculty?
Sure. I'm Aru Nurthy, and I'm representing physicians in Clark County.
Thank you. And I believe that's everyone. Have I missed anybody that popped in after we started? Okay, I think we're ready to go. So the next thing on the agenda. Who's
going to mute your phone again?
Okay. So the next thing we'll be doing is do a formal approval of our previous minutes. So has everyone? Do we have a quorum by now, Doreen?
We do. Yes.
Okay, great. Then. Hopefully folks have had a chance to read the minutes. There's been a lot going on in our meeting, so there was quite a bit. And Doreen, thank you again for the marvelous job you do of capturing the salient points of very big meetings. So I'm going to ask for someone to make a motion to accept the minutes, and then I'll want a second.
I move to approve the longest minutes we've had in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'll second.
Then we have a nomination and a second, and we'll all vote. Please just vote aye if you accept the minutes of the meeting. Aye.
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 Aye. Is anyone opposed to accepting the minutes? Hearing none, then we will consider the minutes accepted, and thank you everyone for that. So I'm gonna just go through the agenda really briefly. There's a lot going on out there in the world. Dr. Malik?
Can I go ahead and introduce the counselor?
Yes, please.
Sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to, I'm really pleased to introduce to all of you our newest counselor and our newest member of our Board of Health, Counselor Bowerman, who one of the first things she wanted to do as a new Board of Health member is to meet and get introduced to the Public Health Advisory Council. So I'm really pleased to introduce Councillor Bowerman. I don't know if you want to say a few words or...
I would be delighted. I'm always delighted to say a few words, Dr. Melnick, you know. I am so thrilled to know that this group is so active as you are, because it is so incredibly important for achieving the kind of public health that this county needs and deserves. And without your input, I think we'd be in a very different place. So thank you very much for what you do. And I just look forward tonight and in the future for learning more and really applauding your many contributions. Thank you.
We're delighted to have you here. Thank you. And come visit anytime you like.
Will do.
Excellent. Okay. Well, so tonight we're going to have a, I don't think we have anybody. Is there anybody on the phone or that I have not aware of that wanted to make a public comment? Hearing none, we'll continue on. So tonight's agenda is going to primarily be the department and the COVID-19 update. There's just an awful lot going on, and so I think we'll take it away. There will be some time for Q&A at the end. So I think I'll turn this over to Dr. Melnick and Roxanne, and thank you for coming prepared to share a lot of information with the committee tonight.
Sorry to, I changed the agenda, but can we have Bridget go first? Because she has to jump off the meeting for something.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you, Marla.
Thanks for asking.
So, Bridget.
You don't think that is my cue, maybe?
Yeah. Bridget Bashaw is our food safety program manager. The food safety program has been incredibly busy during COVID, since more than a year ago now. And Bridget has done an outstanding job really supporting our food establishments and making sure that they're safe and we're safe. And she continues, her and her team have continued to really be leaders, I think, in the state. I'm regularly on environmental health director meetings, and we have, with Bridget's leadership, really been leaders in the state around our approach to COVID and what we're doing in Clark County. So Bridget's here to talk about, take it away, Bridget.
Changes in the restaurant inspections. Thank you, Janice. Thank you everybody for having me tonight. I am here to share information about a recent temporary shift in the food safety program, and the way what we've changed is we've moved from in-person scored inspections to a system of scheduled unscored assessments, is what we're calling them. So no more inspections, now we're doing assessments. And it's temporary. I will highlight the differences between the two, touch on some of why and how, and share why I don't have concerns with the temporary unscored and scheduled approach to food safety. Clark County has continued to, up until now, offer in-person food safety inspections throughout the pandemic, while other counties in the state have chosen not to conduct inspections, to conduct only high-priority inspections, or to use a hybrid approach, such as incorporating unscored assessments. So far, throughout this last year, we've inspected just over 1,000. We've conducted just over 1,000 inspections, where within the same time period between 2017 and 18, we had conducted over 2,300 routine inspections. So even though we've been out there trying to do inspections, the number of inspections we've been able to do is much, much less. For the first many months of the pandemic, we often found businesses were temporarily closed or that their hours were greatly reduced. And when we're actually conducting inspections now, we tend to find that space within the food establishment is too small to efficiently complete the work we're there to do and also maintain social distancing requirements. There are some other challenges and considerations that we factored into this move to scheduled virtual assessments. Some of those include that many food establishments are operating with bare bones staffing levels, and accommodating an unannounced inspection can be very challenging for the business portion of that operation. There are food establishment owners and food workers who are very concerned about the size of their COVID bubble, and they can be wary of having an inspector show up unannounced and then be remaining in their space, even at a 6-foot social distance, remaining in their space for an hour or more. And some of our own staff have not been able to conduct inspections due to individual health concerns or assignment to the ongoing pandemic response. Additionally, as food establishments are allowed to again increase their indoor dining capacity, the number of employees they have in their kitchen increases, and that makes it even more challenging for inspectors to do their work and maintain social distancing requirements. The move to assessments allows us an opportunity to have discussion of food safety topics, assess high-risk violations, and discuss modifications that a food establishment business might be proposing to their facility or their menu throughout the pandemic. While we still are able to minimize or even eliminate the need for an inspector to be physically present in the establishment. For those food establishment owners choosing not to participate in the virtual assessment option that we're offering, we do still retain an option for in-person assessments. It's just at a smaller amount of time that we spend in a food establishment. So we retain both. We get recognized that there are some business owners out there that just maybe aren't all that fluid in virtual technology, and it might not work for them. And if that's the case, then we can accommodate that. The assessment is separated into two parts. We call the first part the pre-assessment, and then the second part is the actual assessment. Both ideally are pre-scheduled and they occur virtually. During the pre-assessment, we aim to spend about 20 to 30 minutes discussing policies and practices around high-risk violations, such as proper hand washing, ill worker reporting, or how bare hand contact is prevented while they're doing their food service. And then, of course, we touch on the current COVID measures that are in place at the time. And then during the actual assessment, the person in charge leads the inspector through the establishment with a cell phone, and they demonstrate equipment and product temperatures, final cook temperatures, any other active food preparation activities that might be occurring, such as cooling or reheating practices. So it really mimics what a food inspection would look like. We've just broken it up into two parts, and the person in charge is leading the demonstration through the food establishment virtually. So there were some comments posted on Facebook in response to a recent short Colombian article that was informing the public of this temporary change. And so I wanted to address those. Some of the comments focused on why the change is being made now, how the public could continue to feel safe with this change from unannounced scored inspections to unscored and scheduled inspections. So how the public can feel safe in that arrangement. And of course, the accusation that if we're not doing inspections in person, then we must be doing nothing at all. So I can speak to a few of those things. To the question of why now, I feel that now is definitely not too late. I would have liked for this to have gone live a couple of months ago, sure. And if we had a fully available staff over the past year, I'm certain that we could have made that happen. But of course, we have been helping respond to the pandemic. Some of our staff are assigned to the pandemic response. And that results, and not just our staff, but other department staff are responding to the pandemic also. which means that not only do we have fewer staff in the food program, but we also have fewer staff in other programs that we need to collaborate with in order to make a smooth transition in a process such as this. Doing in-person inspections and moving to a virtual inspection process is a pretty big process change when you take into account that we have 12 different inspectors and we're working with the public. We have 1,700 permit facilities that we are intending to reach out to and offer this option to. We have inspection forms and a database that needed some manipulating in order to accommodate this change. So we needed to work with our IT staff, our customer service staff, and of course train our own staff. So there's a little bit of behind the scenes work involved, and we need to, you know, our program staff to be available to do that. So some of the other reasons why there was a, I don't know that I'd call it a delay, but why we're rolling this out now versus 3 months ago or 6 months ago. We're also keeping current with the ever-changing COVID measures that impact food establishments. We're consulting with and educating business owners who are considering making modifications to their business models in light of COVID. We're responding to more public concerns about food establishments not following the required COVID measures. And we are continually working to provide financial relief to owners who are up for permit renewal. So those are some additional things that we're doing that we've taken on in light of COVID. We also have a pretty healthy plan review submittal continuing right now. We're about 75 to 80% of our usual numbers. So plan reviews are continuing to come in as well. So moving to virtual assessments has been a project priority project amid many other priority projects for us. And I'm proud of the fact that all of our team is now conducting these assessments. There are counties this week that have again been moved back a phase. I have no idea when food establishments are going to be able to open fully and without social distancing requirements. So I think that having this virtual assessment option in place allows us more of an opportunity to discuss food safety topics with owners, regardless of which phase we're in and regardless of a person's individual health status or their individual health concerns. To questions around how scheduled inspections could adequately assess actual food worker practices, these food safety assessments will focus conversation and observation on high-risk compliance items that are most often associated with foodborne illness. And non-compliance of any items that we see, of any high-risk items we observe during the assessment, will still require immediate corrections, just the same as they would during a routine inspection. And I think some people will say, well, they know you're there. How could a food worker possibly commit a violation while they know you're there? Or you had this pre-arranged. They can know we're there when we're doing inspections all the time. It may be unannounced, but once we're there, they know we're there, and you know, food workers will still maybe not wash their hands as they're required to, or not wear gloves as they're required to, or in the right way. So I do expect that we will see violations. And when we do, we'll be able to address those required immediate changes just as we normally would. And then of course, we do retain all of the same enforcement tools that we normally have. So if we are doing a virtual inspection or assessment of a food establishment and we're seeing that there are enough violations present that would normally, if we were to see those, they would accrue a score and that would trigger a closure, we still maintain that option to close people. We'll still work through that process. And if that means that we need to end up going to the establishment in person, we still have that option. So assessments are pre-scheduled, so it is possible that we would see fewer compliance violations, but that's not particularly concerning to me. I think knowing of an inspection allows owners and food workers an opportunity to ensure that everything is at its best. And if a food worker identifies that a cooler is not adequately holding food below 41 degrees before we get there, and they then notify the owner and that cooler gets fixed, that's a good thing overall. We issued somewhere around 1,000 thermometer violations in 2018. And if we issue fewer of those going forward because people put forth the effort to make sure they had all the equipment in place prior to our inspection, such as thermometers, I think that also, you know, would be considered a win. And should there be a situation where, maybe we're watching someone wash their hands, we have an employee washing hands, a person in charge pointing a camera at them, so the person knows they are being observed washing their hands, and then we're doing that observation, and that isn't being done correctly, that gives us an opportunity. Like, that is an opportunity to identify a trainee. And so we have that opportunity to talk with the person in charge about their onboarding training and their ongoing training. So I think that there are a lot of opportunities for the assessment to identify shortfalls or areas where food safety practices can be improved. It also gives us an opportunity to strengthen relationships with the food workers and the owners. And we'll be capitalizing on those. There are some other jurisdictions across the nation who have been doing assessments in a similar way for quite a while now. And they're sharing that the food owners are really taking on ownership of this opportunity and are really openly sharing information about their businesses and appreciate the opportunity to still protect the community and appreciate the fact that the regulatory agency is kind of giving them some ownership in conducting these inspections. And then, of course, to claims that a move from unannounced inspections to scheduled inspections would somehow result in less work completed by our program staff, that is just not correct. Time estimates for the assessments of a food establishment versus a routine inspection of a food establishment are very comparable. The amount of time that it takes to coordinate the assessment and the conversations with the food establishment more or less replace the amount of time it would take for us to drive to a facility. In closing, knowledgeable staff and active managerial control within a food establishment are really the most effective tools for preventing foodborne illness. The assessment process allows us an opportunity to continue having food safety conversations during the pandemic while impressing the ongoing importance of social distancing to help reduce the spread of COVID-19. Food workers and food establishment owners are always responsible for safe food handling practices. The FDA and the State Department of Health food codes refer to this as active managerial control, which means the purposeful use of specific policies and procedures in the food establishment to control foodborne illness risk factors and embodies a preventative rather than reactive approach to food safety through a continuous system of training, monitoring, and verification. And I view this temporary move to assessments as an opportunity to kind of reinforce the responsibility that food workers and food owners have of incorporating active managerial control into their practices. So that's a lot of information. That's a nutshell summary of what embodies the food safety assessment approach that we've implemented. And I'm happy to hear your thoughts on that approach and can take any questions that you might have.
Questions from our council? This is pretty timely since some people are just beginning to get back into food establishments, and some people like our family is just finally starting to do takeout. So it is really good to know that there is that still good attention being paid to food safety in the community. Any questions from our group?
Well, go ahead. The only thing I wanted to add was that we will still be doing in-person inspections of temporary events, which this time of year are really starting to ramp up. And as Bridget has explained to me, it's just logistically it would be challenging to do inspections of those. And also that while Bridget's team has spent some time modifying the assessment tool to fit Clark County needs, the original tool is actually developed by the Department of Health. So this has been used in other counties and is not something that we created from scratch. So it's been, I mean, I'm guess you couldn't really say validated, but close.
Contested a little bit.
Yeah. So thank you, Bridget.
Yeah, thank you. Also, I wanted to also just say how much I think our business owners and our community appreciate that while there's an enforcement element to this, this is really educational, and we're really focused on making them successful and providing the feedback and the information so that they can be as successful as possible. Because seriously, there's no restaurant that wants to make their customers sick. And so in many cases, it's not that they're doing this, you know, they're not violating things, you know, policy on purpose. It's just there's you know, some training that needs to happen. And the fact that you're, you know, that your team is seen as folks that they can confide in and that can provide that training, I think is really excellent and a testament to the great work you're doing. So thank you very much, Bridget, for that.
Yeah, we're trying to strengthen more of those relationships. Definitely not everyone sees us that way, but the more that we can be present and act as a resource and, you know, prove ourselves as a partner, the better.
Yeah, and I just want to express appreciation for Bridget and her team, because even long before the pandemic, their team and their, I don't know if you call it culture or what, is not about enforcement. It's about really working with the restaurants, the, you know, the industry. We all have common interest here in safety. So, you know, certainly we have the enforcement capability, but the culture, if you want to call it that, of the staff and the team is to be is to work in partnership with the industry.
Yeah, for the most part, we're working to, when there's a violation observed, we are working for behavioral change. And we're only at a food establishment 3 times a year, usually at best. And so we're not going to enforce behavioral change just with 3 visits a year or a pretty hefty re-inspection fine. You know, we're really relying on more of that to develop from within the establishment and have the person in charge really assume that, the ownership.
One of the things I was going to comment on, Bridget, is I don't know if you're aware or not, but the governor had actually earmarked a bunch of masks for the restaurant industry. So there's an allotment of about 50,000 AN95s and regular masks that are to be donated to the restaurant. So if you identify a need, that's a resource that we can tap into and bring to bear for any of those food establishments.
Okay, I think that there would be a lot of food establishments that would likely take advantage of that opportunity if there was a way for them to get that, because it's an additional expense, definitely, acquiring masks during this time. The costs I'm hearing have gone up quite a bit for gloves and masks that are difficult to get right now, still. So that's if it's available in Clark County at a local level, I would more than happy to share that with the establishments. I think that it would be widely received.
Yeah, absolutely. You can have them contact us at CRESA, and we can help them out there.
Okay, great. I'll be in touch. I don't want to share information in any newsletter. I want to make sure I'm sharing the correct information in any newsletter.
Do that.
Thank you.
Bridget, I've had a question from a constituent recently. They wanted to know, and they had lived in California not too long ago, and of course there the score, the assessment of a restaurant is posted in their window by law, and they wanted to know why that is not done in Clark County. What's the answer?
Right. I think there are mixed reviews on how effective that is overall. Washington State doesn't require that. There are some counties, I think that King County is a jurisdiction that does post a letter grade on windows. I think that some of the concern could be pressure on a food inspector, where they may or may not apply violations consistently if it's going to be publicized that widely. I mean, it is a publicized, you know, it's public information. We do post it on our website. It is posted in the newspaper. But you can build, a food inspector can build a relationship with an operator over a course of time. And this is one reason why we switch
areas on a regular basis every 3 years or so, because you can build relationships with businesses. And if you know that putting a D or an F in their window is going to, you know, have a financially negative impact on their family, then somebody might be less willing to issue the violations that they're observing. I think that's one of the thoughts around why maybe not to do that. There are, you know, other thoughts on why to do that. It makes the public more informed, where our system in Clark County is that somebody need to actually go online and find the information, seek it out for themselves. So there's pros and cons to both sides. It's just not something that, I think it was considered by previous management in my position. I've only been in this position for about, well, 2.5 years now. I have to stop saying only. but previous management, I think, did consider that when Seattle King was introducing their rollout of that approach. And at that time, we decided not to do that. And I haven't really considered it deeply since I started in this position.
When I got my master's in public health, I had to do a thesis, and it was on the association between restaurant scores and risks of foodborne illness. And at that time, I think I was doing it in Oregon, and they for the minor violations, they doubled points if they weren't corrected each time. But the association between a numerical score and what, you know, there's some items on the inspection, Bridge, I don't know how you feel about this, but there's some items on the inspection that are more related to risk, like temperatures or cross-contamination and hygiene, than others. And the score itself, while helpful, you really need to look at what's beneath the score, like what are the specific violations that are found in terms of foodborne illness risk.
Yeah, that's certainly very true.
Any other questions for Bridget? Well, that was really excellent. Thank you so much, Bridget, for providing us with a great report. And before we move on, Janice, thank you for catching. I almost skipped over the environmental public health update. Is there anything else that you wanted to bring to the group from environmental public health?
No, that was it. Thank you, Marla.
Thank you. That was excellent. Okay, then. Now we are ready for the director's report, so thank you.
I think Jeff is going to do a budget update first, or do we not have a budget update?
I was going to just speak at a very high level as we were entering the budget season for 2022, just to give FAC a very quick briefing. Most of you have been on FAC for quite a while. Those of you who have not, I presented this in the past. Public health at the national level has an unsustainable budget model wherein that funding is stagnant. For example, I've been here since 1998, and I can tell you one of our federal grants has been $334,110 for more than 20 years. As you would expect, though, our costs continue to increase every year. Labor costs increase, supplies costs increase, et cetera, et cetera. And our revenues are stagnant. So we basically have an unsustainable budget model that leads to deficits pretty much every budget. We try to be as creative as we can. We bring forward adjustments to our environmental public health fee schedule, for example. We're moving more towards a 100% cost basis with those fees. The council has been great in the past, giving us those adjustments as needed. Typically, the environmental public health fees cover about 40%, for example, of our county indirects. So you can see as the unit, the environmental public health unit, they do, those fees are very critical. We have no profit factor built into those fees. It's strictly based on cost of doing business. So I can almost guarantee you we will have a budget deficit for 2022 that we're facing once we get all the data from the budget office, which will be very soon. We meet again in 2 months, I believe, in June. At that point, I'll brief FAC on our budget situation and our fee situation. We may be asking for support with the county council for addressing the budget deficit. That was pretty much what I was going to do for the overall budget picture. For COVID, We have received some federal funding sources to address COVID response in 2021. Unfortunately, the federal funding has been categorical and really not proportionate to what our response is. We have significant funding to do testing and case investigation and contact tracing, but we're lacking funding for the vaccine planning and administration. The county council did give us $5 million of general fund at the end of 2020, which is now part of our fund balance. Even with that, though, the amount of revenue we've received to cover the vaccine work is, we're really not there. We really are looking at a deficit there as well. I'm working with the Department of Health very closely, trying to access some FEMA funding. I don't have a response yet from them. They've been going to another state agency to ask some questions if we're actually qualified to receive those funds. So I'll also keep FAC briefed on that. So those are the two budget topics I wanted to be sure I'm covered tonight with FAC. If there are any questions, I can field them now at this point. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. This is very helpful.
So I think next up is a COVID-19 update. I'm going to go ahead and try to share my screen here and find the right one. Can you all see that?
I can definitely see it.
Now I'm going to try and move things around so I can actually start the slideshow. That look okay?
Yes.
Great. I may have to move you all around, your pictures all around here to go through this. So, and feel free to ask questions. So, and I'll try to go through this as quickly as possible. I certainly want time for questions. So, in the United States, the case numbers are increasing nationally, and there are concerns about the possibility of a fourth wave. So, we've had three waves, you know, a year ago, and then a fall winter wave in November, December, and January. And there's concerns that we're going to have a fourth wave. And the latest data from the CDC shows an increase in cases, hospitalizations, unfortunately a decrease in deaths, but we know the deaths lag behind by a few weeks, the cases and hospitalizations. But it also could be that we've gotten more of our elderly population vaccinated. So there may be some positive news in that as well. In Washington State, transmission is increasing. The reproductive number is the number of cases that each case transmits to, so that each case results in. So if it's below one, that means the transmission is going down. It's kind of like how many children you have. If it's above one, the population goes up. So you multiply, and it's also like, I guess, compounded in interest, but 1.38 times 1.38 and so forth results in an exponential increase in number of cases, and that's pretty high. The case numbers, so we had had a high levels back in December, January, and then they came down in the, statewide. The case numbers began increasing in late March following a February plateau. Many counties, there's variation, but many counties are seeing increases, including four of the five largest counties. And this has actually been true since the beginning of the pandemic, but the populations that are most likely to be cases are in young and middle-aged adults. And that's where we're seeing increases now. Hospital admissions remain flat statewide during the first 3 weeks of March, but are increasing now. So numbers are going up statewide. In Clark County, back in January, we're at the point where we're having 200 cases or more per day, and I'll show you a graphic on that. Then things came down after that third wave, and we plateaued at about 37 cases per day. But as you can see, last week, we were up to 46 cases per day. Over this past weekend, we averaged about 50. And then there was the state data system was, the WDRS is down on Sunday. So reporting was kind of delayed. But when we look at the numbers that we reported out yesterday, on Monday, 76 cases per day. And I just want to use that number, 76 cases yesterday reported. So if we were to continue at more than 72 cases per day, our metric over 14 days would be more than 200 per 100,000. Here we're seeing cases among younger adults as well as in the state. And our case rate per 100,000 over 14 days back in January was at 474. We went down to 88.8 in mid-March, but now we're up to 139.8 this week. I also want to put this in perspective. 88.8 sounds pretty low coming back from that third wave, but back last summer when we were applying to open up a phase in terms of opening the county up, our rate was below 20, it was 19-something. So we've gotten used to fairly high rates of COVID-19 transmission. Our hospitalizations, we want them about below 10%. Right now, they're about 5% of hospital beds are occupied with COVID-19 cases. So here's this is our first wave here back in March and April. Then here's our summer wave. And then here's our late fall to winter wave. And you can see if each one, you have a plateau, it gets a little bit higher, and then you go up. And then here's the plateau we had in March, and you can see the increases here. So these bars are the cases per day, and the green line here is cumulative number of cases. But the concern is that we may be embarking on another wave here, and I'll talk about why that is the case. Here's a number of cases we've had so far, a little bit over 20,000. Probable cases are confirmed cases are people. I'm sorry, we've had about 21,000 confirmed cases are people who have a positive polymerase chain reaction. That's a test for the RNA of the virus. Those are confirmed cases, and then probable cases are the positive antigen test. The antigen test isn't quite as accurate as the PCR, and it actually tests for the protein. Part of the virus. We treat probable cases like confirmed. They're isolated and they're close contacts. When we interview them, they're close contacts or are quarantined. The active cases are people who are actually contagious at the current time. So that would be somebody who is either a probable or an active case and you're contagious for 10 days after symptom onset and until whichever comes later, 24 hours after fever resolves and after symptoms are resolving as well. Symptoms are resolving. So, and that's fever being gone without any medication to reduce fever. So that's an active case. So that would be somebody still in isolation. And we're only including in the rate confirmed cases. Now we're including both to line up with the DOH data. But many more of the cases are confirmed compared to probable. So it makes a little bit of difference, but not huge. So one of the concerns we have in terms of the increase is the appearance of variants. And variants are basically genetic. Every time the virus replicates, and one of the reasons to get the cases down is the more virus that's out there replicating, the virus replicates its RNA, its genetic makeup, and that's an opportunity each time a virus replicates for a mutation to arise, and those mutations can lead to variants. And they lead to both, variants of concern and variants of interest. And variants of concern are the genetic changes in the virus that can make it more transmissible, more lethal, less responsive to less protected by the vaccines that are around. And variants of interest may be those that are associated with requiring higher antibody levels to neutralize them in terms of the they're more resistant to the antibodies produced by the vaccine, and may also be kind of more resistant to the current treatments like monoclonal antibodies. So the variants of concern are transmissibility, severity, and less responsive to the vaccine. Those are concerns. The most prominent variants in Washington are the UK variant, the 117 variant, and that's from arose in the United Kingdom, and then two California variants. The concern about the 117 variant is that it is more transmissible. A recent study, as you can see there, I'm not going to read it, showed that it in a low-risk population, this variant actually caused 60% more mortality than people who are infected with other variants or garden variety original strain of COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Some more recent studies suggest that that's not the case. So the jury is out on that one. The good news about the 117 variant is that existing vaccines, the three vaccines, are effective against it. Then we have the California variants, and they're slightly more contagious than the original, SARS-CoV-2 virus we had here. The antibody treatments, like, for example, monoclonal antibodies, may be less effective against these strains. These are the numbers, but I should tell you that these are just the numbers we've identified. Let me see what the next slide. So not all infections are tested for variants. So the state is doing surveillance on about 5% of the cases undergo genomic studies to see whether they're variants or not. So we have a 5% group, and then specimens are tested for other reasons. So if somebody has a patient with an unusual clinical presentation, we like to send those for genomic testing, because you want to know whether you've got a variant that's causing more severe disease that you might not ordinarily expect. For example, somebody with an unusual symptoms or severe disease in a young person, for example. If we have an outbreak that has a large attack rate, so you have a group of people, kind of a super spreader type event where you get a lot of cases, we want to test those also, because we want to identify whether there might be a more transmissible variant responsible. If we have an outbreak or a school and a hospital, we might want to test for variants, because we might want to understand how transmission might have occurred, so we can identify areas for improvement in terms of transmission prevention. If we've got a case of somebody who previously had COVID-19 and then they've gone 3 months, 90 days since their infection, and they get a new infection, a reinfection, we might want to test those for variants, as well as people who are fully vaccinated, and we call this vaccine breakthrough, which I'll talk about in a minute. Or maybe I can go ahead and talk about it here. Somebody who's fully vaccinated is somebody who's 2 weeks past their second dose of Moderna or Pfizer, or 2 weeks after the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. If those folks get infected and have a positive test, we want to test those for variants also, because then we become concerned that somebody has a variant that's resistant to the vaccine. So we've been testing those as well. So that's how we identify variants. In Washington right now, 90%, the vast majority of infections are variants of concern. And the B.1.1.7 variant is increasing most quickly. So earlier this month is 34% of the cases were attributed to that more transmissible UK variant, and it's projected right about now to be responsible for 50% of cases in Washington state. And it's going to crowd out, earlier this month, the two California variants were responsible for about 50% of the cases, but they double, they replicate slower than the B117 variant, and so 117 is expected to overtake them and be responsible for 50% of cases by mid-April, which is coming up soon. The reason I'm saying all this is that this is not a time to let our guard down in terms of the pandemic. We still have a large proportion of the population that's unvaccinated, and we've got these variants present, and if we're not careful in terms of how we behave in terms of masking and distancing, we can see a rapid increase. So we're in a race against the virus, and we want to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible. We don't want the variants to take over, and we certainly don't want the emergence of variants that are resistant to vaccines. This is true, actually, not just in Washington, but nationally as well as globally. We need to have the virus numbers down because variants can emerge anywhere. In terms of opening up, on Monday, that was this past Monday, the 12th, the governor's office provided the first evaluation of reopening metrics since the plan was modified last month. And to remain in phase three, we needed both, we needed only one of the two, either between below 200 per 100,000 case rate over 14 days, or the hospitalization number to be fewer per 100,000 over 7 days. Originally, you had to meet both. Governor Inslee announced that now you only had to meet, you'd only move back to phase two if you failed to meet both metrics. So if you meet one of them, you stay in phase three. So we actually met both of them, and Clark County will stay in phase three until May 3rd when they do the next evaluation. And then if we may stay in phase three after that, if our numbers get worse, and you know, in terms of not meeting that metric, then we would pull back to phase two as of May 7th. There were three counties in the state that fell back to phase two. They were Cowlitz, Pierce, and Whitman counties all fell back to phase two. The case rate in Cowlitz County, where I'm also the health officer, is over 332. It's around 332 per 100,000. Remember, ours is about 139. And their hospitalizations per 100,000 over 7 days, I think was 11.8 or 11.9. So they were well above the five. And that's why Cowlitz fell back. So, you know, we're looking at this closely because the rates are higher in Cowlitz, you know, we're obviously nearby. And then, you know, I heard in the press that the governor in Oregon moved some of the counties in the Portland area back as well. So it's all around us. The good news is the state vaccine allocation to Clark County continues to be good. I don't think I've spoken to you all for a while here, but during the first 11 weeks when vaccine was available, we got the allocation to Clark County was significantly lower than other counties within the state. We only received about 4,000, a little bit over 40, just under 4,200 doses a week. Our team looked at 15 counties in the state, large counties, medium counties, and small counties. And we were I think we were one from the bottom of the list in terms of our vaccine allocation. Our Board of Health, our County Council, our legislative delegation, Congresswoman Herrera Butler, our other entities and agencies, and I think our cities, it was a mass concern to the state about the allocation. And in the last 6 weeks, you can see that Our allocation has more than tripled in terms of the amount of vaccine we're getting. And in addition to that, there's more vaccine because of the federal allocation. For example, the tower, so the 13,980 first doses per week we've been getting is through the state. We also get federal allocation. It's actually over 10,000 doses a week. And that's what we're using at the Tower Mall site. In terms of eligibility to get the vaccine, we've opened it up to phase, 1B, tiers 1 to 4. Those included, first it was essential workers, then it was, then it opened up to people living and working in congregate settings. It was people who were over 16 who had coexisting conditions at two or more, and then anybody pregnant, 16 and older, was pregnant. Beginning Thursday, which is 2 days from now, everyone over the age, everyone 16 and years and older would be eligible to get vaccinated. And hopefully, once the vaccine allocation increased in Clark County, you know, we had had that waiting list that was over 30,000 people. That quickly went down to zero. So I'm actually optimistic that given the vaccine availability, we'll be able to move a large number of people through without the appointments getting jammed. I haven't heard, speaking to our providers, there hasn't been difficulty people getting appointments. And I know that even at places like the fairground site, where appointments are getting filled up as soon as that they opened, there's appointments available a couple of days later at least. So it's easier to get in now. Now our color on the state comparing to other counties, we still have to catch up. But you can see that in Clark County now, we're well below the comparable to other counties. But now nearly 30% of our residents have received at least one dose, and nearly 20% are fully vaccinated. So that's pretty good news. We're a long way from herd immunity, and that may be elusive anyway. But the more people we get vaccinated, that helps reduce transmission. We might be seeing things a lot worse in terms of a fourth wave if we didn't have a fair amount of people fully vaccinated at this point. With the Tower Mall site continues, it's a partnership with the City of Vancouver and Safeway. We can do over 1,000 doses a day. It's open 4 days a week. We're in our sixth week of operations, and we're administering right now mostly second doses for those who received their first doses in the first 3 weeks of operation. But during the seventh week, starting this Friday, we'll have 1,000 first dose appointments available for each of the 4 days of operation. We've also been working to increase access to vaccine for populations that have difficulty getting access, both in mobile and short-term fixed sites. We've recently been working with food processing facilities to do on-site clinics at these food processing plants, and we prioritize these facilities that have had outbreaks, for example, like a Firestone fruit company, and also have diverse workforces, for example, BIPOC populations working there. We've actually done 4 food processing facilities in Clark and Callis. And we're able to vaccinate about 550 employees. And we're continuing to look for opportunities to reach some of these underserved populations. The latest news that you might have heard is about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So there have been 6 reported cases of rare and severe blood clots in the brain, actually. And associated with low platelet levels in people who received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So I might want to point out that this is incredibly rare. There's been close to 7 million doses of the vaccine administered in the United States, and we have 6 cases among these more than 7 million doses, close to 7 million doses. These cases, I'm not sure I have the, let me mention a little bit more description. These cases occurred in women between the ages of 18 and 48, so they're in young women. I don't have much more information about that. I do want to point out that a couple of other points. One is we're going to get information out to providers. We're working on messaging now that it's a type in terms of the clots associated with low platelets. It also seems to be some sort of hypersensitivity phenomenon, not responsive to and actually treating with heparin, which is used to treat a deep venous thrombosis clots, you can actually make it worse. So we'll be getting information out to providers about that. But it's a really rare event. And the other thing I want to point out about this is you hear our surveillance system, the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, or VAERS. There's been a lot of discussion about VAERS on social media. VAERS does not identify cause and effect. Virtually anything that is adverse happens in some sort of in people who receive the vaccine. And I'm being actually literal about this. You could fall off a ladder a couple of days after getting the vaccine, and your information can be entered into VAERS. Getting the Moderna vaccine for second dose when you're supposed to get Pfizer, something like that goes into VAERS as well. It captures, it's basically, it broadly captures anything that happens after vaccine. So it doesn't prove cause and effect, but what it does do is the data from VAERS is mined continuously. So if you actually see a pattern of something unusual, and this is a perfect example, VAERS is pretty sensitive at picking that up. So the VAERS system was able to identify these six cases out of 6.8 million doses received. And that resulted in the CDC and the FDA basically putting a pause on administering this vaccine. 149,000 doses have been administered in Washington, and we don't have any knowledge of where these six cases lived. And we don't know whether any of them are Washington County residents. But the point I want to make is our VAERS system, is our surveillance system, does pick these things up. And I think it can give us some confidence that there's methods in place to basically ensure safety of the vaccines. And it says here, safety is a top priority. And the CDC will be meeting with the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices to review the cases. And as I mentioned earlier, we have a robust vaccine safety monitoring system. It was identified quickly and addressed. Oh, here it is. Here are the cases. Women between the ages of 18 and 48. And the symptoms occurred 6 to 13 days after vaccination. We're going to be getting messages out to the public about when they need, if they've been received this vaccine, and they have these symptoms, they should contact their healthcare provider. And we're also going to we've got information about this pause out to healthcare providers and community partners. We were planning on doing a pod this Saturday. Was going to use Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and we canceled it. So we're not getting rid of the vaccine. The vaccine is a very safe and effective vaccine. Until we hear from the CDC and the FDA, though, we're not going to be administering it to anybody in Clark County. And I think that's it for my presentation. So I'll stop the share so we can all see each other really well. Sorry for I hope I didn't go on too long there. Any questions?
So we have a pretty good amount of time on the agenda for question and answer period. That there's a lot going on out there right now. And thank you, Dr. Melnick, for bringing us up to date on some of the most current situations. So I hope that people feel free to ask questions about what we just heard. And maybe that hearing that information reminded folks of other questions that they may have. So please feel free to to use this time to put your questions out there.
We have a couple of other physicians here who can help me out too if I make any mistakes. Well, you're all still awake.
I did want to add, we've made some really, really good progress with our call center as well. And this week we're going live with specific 800 numbers for our BIPOC community. So we have a special number, an 800 number that was set up specifically for our NAACP partners, for our Latinx partners, and also our Pacific Islander population partners. That started this week, and we're going to actually be utilizing our call center to also help with scheduling special appointments for our community members that have had a lot of barriers and haven't had an opportunity to get in at the Tower Mall site. So we're really excited about that. That's actually launching, and it launched today. So that's really good news, and we've got really, really great feedback from our partners. They very much appreciate that work. So just want to share.
You made me think of something else, because we need to do a much better job statewide as well as countywide getting communities of color, those populations vaccinated. So one of the things we're doing statewide is the vaccine itself is free. So the vaccine is paid for if you're a provider administering the vaccine. But the cost of administration, the staff, the people who, make the appointments, put the, stick the needles into the arms and all that. That administration fee is not covered. And so providers basically attempt to recover that cost, which is substantial, by billing the patients. And that's a concern, because it's a disincentive for providers to do more community outreach, including reaching uninsured populations. But For some of our BIPOC populations, the requirement to produce documentation, whether proof of insurance or the last four digits of your social security number, for example, to identify you, has been an issue. So we're actually, we got together with our colleagues across the state, the Washington State Association of Local Public Health Officials, and we drafted a letter to the state, to the governor and the Department of Health, to see if we can encourage them to provide direct payment to providers when they administer the vaccine. So instead of asking people for insurance or other documentation, what the providers would do would be to give the people the vaccine, just ask the health-related questions, and, name and date of birth so you can enter it into the state immunization information system. And then at the time of entry, when the patient got into that and got the vaccine, then the state would be able to reimburse the provider for administering that vaccine. So a couple of other things that we're concerned about, the requirement from the state that you had to use 95% of the vaccine within 7 days made it difficult to get the vaccine out to populations with difficult access, because there was no lead time in terms of getting people appointments or making it easier for them to get to the appointment. And for our free clinics, the requirement to enter data into the information systems within 24 hours is tough on their staff, so we asked for that to be extended to 48 hours. We also asked for the state to give us more notification or advanced notification for our vaccine allocation. So we drafted that letter. Right now, our partners have agreed to sign on to it. So the State Medical Association, the WSMA, is agreeing to sign on to it. They've got to review the final draft, as well as the Washington Healthcare Alliance, the Washington Healthcare Access Alliance. That's a statewide organization that represents the free clinics around the state. They're signing on, and LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, PICA Washington, the Pacific Islander Community Association of Washington, and the NAACP have offered to sign on to it as well. They're going to review the final document, but we think if we can get direct payment to providers for giving the vaccine, then we're more likely to be able to get populations of difficult access, including communities of color, vaccinated. So I'll keep everybody posted on that, but we're about ready to send that letter in. That's been a barrier. We've heard from our partners about that. When Governor Inslee was down here, he heard some of that, but we're making a formal letter now about that. That got me talking more, I apologize.
Well, you answered part of my question, but so Johnson & Johnson, I had heard, was the preferred vaccination for people who experience homelessness because it's not necessary to try to, you know, find them again. It's sometimes not that easy. So now with this news about Johnson & Johnson, is there any kind of backup plan for being able to reach out to those folks with the other vaccine, or will it be better to just wait for the Johnson & Johnson again?
That's a really good question. And, you know, so first of all, you know, I think an expert, I'm not sure I remember who it was, a while back nationally said, you know, when vaccine was in short supply, even with the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine, you know, we want to vaccinate people quickly. Let's give everybody a first dose and worry about the second doses later. Not a really good suggestion for a couple of reasons. One is the longer you wait to get people the second dose, the less likely they are to come back for the second dose. If you give them one dose, they have a lower immunity, and we're concerned that they might engage in behaviors that are, you know, risky because they've had one dose. But I think the biggest concern is with variants that might have some resistance to the vaccine. If you get only one dose of vaccine and you have a lower level of protection, that could actually encourage the development and the proliferation of resistant variants. So we can get more resistant disease in our community. So you do want to get the second dose to people at the appropriate time, you know. So I wanted to get that out there as well. On the other hand, you know, if the Johnson and I don't know when the Johnson and Johnson vaccine is going to be available. And by the way, the AstraZeneca vaccine had, I think, a similar issue with blood clots. And the AstraZeneca vaccine and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine both use weakened adenovirus to bring the DNA into the immune cells. I think the AstraZeneca uses a simian adenovirus, and the Johnson & Johnson uses a human one. But they both had, you know, those similar concerns, albeit rare. I'm not sure when the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is going to be available. We're going to wait until we hear from the FDA and the CDC. So the bottom line is, if it's going to be a while, I think we need to use the vaccines that we have available. And that means setting up systems that would, you know, do our best, you know, if it's a population like a shelter population or inmates in the jail who may come and go, or, you know, other populations are hard to reach. We need to put systems in place to ensure getting the second dose to those people at the right time. I'm hoping that, you know, when this sorts out, we'll have the Johnson & Johnson vaccine available again. It is really a safe, very safe vaccine. But I'm also concerned, you know, one of the big issues we have moving forward as the vaccine supply gets greater is suspicion or concerns about people about receiving the vaccine. And even if the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is approved, we may have a long way to go in terms of convincing people that they want to take it. So I think we need to use whatever vaccines we have. And if we're using the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, we need to do whatever we can to make sure we get those second doses to people at the appropriate time. That's a real long-winded answer to your question, but if the Johnson & Johnson is not available, I think we have an obligation to vaccinate these folks. They're in congregate settings, for example, high-risk situations. We want to get them vaccinated.
Thank you.
I don't know if anybody on my team or, you know, anybody has anything to add to that. I don't see anybody's say anything.
Okay.
Dr. Melnick, I'm just curious if you're noting any connection with the methodology that is used in AstraZeneca and J&J, because I've heard in both cases now that the blood clots tend to come with people who had low platelets. And I just wonder if there might be a connection there.
So I think that issue has been seen in hypersensitivity reactions. I might call on Dr. Neville here to help me out with this one. But I believe that's seen with the administration of heparin itself, aside from the vaccines, that you can get those kinds of reactions. And it's associated with low platelets. So this clotting situation we've seen is not just isolated. It's a rare event, but it's not just isolated to the vaccines. It's happened elsewhere. I can get more information on that as well.
And Dr. Neville might not realize he's muted. Maybe he's talking.
Hard to say, but it is a hypersensitivity reaction that's been seen elsewhere. And I believe it's been associated with heparin, but I'll verify that for you, Councilor Bowerman.
I have another thing I wanted to know about. It seems like there's been quite a bit of effort, and you described going to people where they work or in situations where we've had some outbreaks and we've brought the vaccine to people where they are. Is that going to continue, that we'll be reaching out? You know, there were some mobile vaccination units that were reaching out to nursing homes and different things. Is that still a good strategy that's being used?
Yeah, and Roxanne, who's incident commander, can comment on this. Do you want to comment on it, or should I go ahead and Roxanne?
You can go in and I will augment as necessary.
Okay, sounds good. So those mobile units take a lot of resources. They are very resource intensive, and you know, we've done several of those. With a one dose vaccine like Johnson & Johnson, you only have to go out once. If we don't have the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and we have to go out twice, that makes them even more resource intensive. We've already reached, you know, some of these workplaces, and we've been able to vaccinate folks there. A couple of other things we need to look at is a couple of other strategies. One is to get our providers, who are also located around the county, to do more. And that's one of the reasons why we're pushing for payment of the administrative fee, for example, you know, direct payment. But the other thing that we can do is maximize the use of the Tower Mall. And, you know, it's only open 4 days right now, but look to opening it more days a week, and working with the call center and with our partners to see what we can do to make it more accessible, or, you know, even for BIPOC populations. And one of the things to possibly consider also, one of the impediments to vaccination is the whole appointment system. So seeing what we can do around that, and allowing, for example, walk-in situations. So other strategies that might be more efficient than the, you know, continuing to do those mobile pods. And now I'll shut up and let Roxanne add or subtract anything I said. Andrea as well has been in operations.
Yeah, and you did an excellent job summarizing everything. But I also, you know, part of this also is utilizing additional resources that are out there as well. And Department of Health, for instance, has reached out. They do have some National Guard resources, and so we've been partnering with them to bring them in to actually vaccinate the school for the deaf and the hearing impaired population. And so they're going to be working on bringing those resources into our county over the next, I think, couple of weeks. we're going to coordinate and hold the vaccine for them, and then when they come into town, we're going to be transporting the vaccine to them so that they can provide that those pods as well. Also to some adult family homes. Folks, not everybody in the adult family homes, for whatever reason, decided to get vaccinated. So we do have a group of people that now are saying, I think I'd like to get vaccinated now. And we also have some others that are recently, you know, admitted to those adult family homes. And so that is very resource intensive, and it's very difficult to set up a pod to go, you know, vaccinate a couple folks. So the Department of Health is also going to be doing those as well with their resources. So we are very much leveraging our partners, our Medical Reserve Corps, our fire department staff, you know, across the county, and I think with our healthcare partners as well, we're really trying to maximize the resources that we have available to get as many vaccines in arms as possible. And those that are having a lot of barriers, we really, from a public health perspective, really focusing on that population. So anyway, Mark continues.
I think both Andrea and Janice, I'm sorry, Janice, I didn't see you because you had your video on. You've been also working in the pod, so you guys may have some other, anything else to add?
You're muted, Janice.
Thank you. I thought you both covered it very, very well. Thank you.
What other questions do you folks have?
I think Katie put something in the chat, so let me look at the chat here. Okay, and Lawrence did as well, so actually I just looked it up. So I just looked up heparin's hypersensitivity, and it can cause low platelets as well. So, and Lawrence, I don't know if you want to add anything to that before we answer Katie's question. Okay. He did put it in the chat, and he may be muted. So, the answer is I just double checked myself and looked it up, Councilor Bowerman. But it is, you know, heparin itself can cause a hypersensitivity reaction with low platelets. So that's why it's not being used to treat these conditions. And it is thought to be some sort of, I don't know if I call it an allergic reaction, but a hypersensitivity reaction to the vaccine. Just like it can occur with heparin itself. Katie was asking about, are there large groups of people that are going to be not interested in getting the vaccine? Is that the question, Katie? And that is a huge concern. And I got to tell you that even in the eligible populations we've had, there's when the school staff became eligible to get vaccine, there are some schools or school districts where the vaccination rate is low. I mean, I think, you know, 40% of folks who are eligible did not choose to get vaccinated. We've seen this in healthcare as well. So there are different groups of people for different reasons may choose not to get vaccinated, even though it's available to them. So we're working, and there's a lot of different terms for it, vaccine hesitancy. Everybody's got different reasons for this, and we're actually, and I don't know, Marissa's not here on the call, but we're with our communication specialist, we're developing a campaign. It's called the I Got a Shot campaign, to basically have people who are willing to go on record, and basically we're using social media and other media to have them illustrate them hopefully getting a shot and explaining why they're doing it. When you can get some people vaccinated, and if you have a population that is opposed to the vaccine or is skeptical about it or suspicious of it, the more people in that population can get vaccinated and they can talk to each other about it and say, it worked for me, and that's one way of dealing with it. But we do need to get a communication campaign out there. You know, we are going to be working on that to get information out about the safety and efficacy of the vaccine. I don't know if anybody on our team wants to, Roxanne, Andrea, Janice, any of you want to comment on that at all or add to what I've just said?
No, I mean, I think you covered it, and I certainly would ask Janice and Andrea to weigh in as well. I think we're,
you know, the ongoing outreach and our community partners helping with the messages is also going to help. But really providing that consistent message, I think, is going to be really critical. Andrea or Janice, did you have something to add?
Just that people's reasons for being hesitant differ. Some are based on religious conviction. Some are concerns related to health, general distrust of government. And I think that we've done a good job partnering with our community organizations to individualize to the greatest extent possible our approaches to ensuring that these folks have the information they need to make informed decisions.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I just want to re-emphasize that the diversity is, the different groups have different reasons, and we have to tailor them and understand what their issues are and involve people from those populations to help with this and listen, do a lot of listening.
So I just received today, and maybe some of you did too, but from the Washington Secretary of Health, a message that went out to providers, and I probably received it because I have a nursing license. It's a whole toolkit on how to basically be an ambassador to the community to help spread the facts about vaccination. Did anyone else in this meeting receive that?
Yeah, our communication folks have it as well.
Yeah, and I thought that was, that seemed like a good idea, because the number of people that would receive this is a large number, and if everyone takes the opportunity to use the toolkit and reach out to other people that they might know that are reluctant to get the vaccination, it might help. So anyway, I just wanted to see if other folks were aware of that. Any other questions for Dr. Melnick or the leadership team that we have present? I'll throw out one that I have been hearing lately, excuse me, and that has to do with the fact that Pfizer is being touted as having a vaccine that prevents infection. Whereas what we were hearing and still are hearing, I think, about Moderna is that the vaccine prevents severe illness, but not necessarily infection. Therefore, a vaccinated person could still acquire the virus and spread it. Dr. Melnick or anyone else, what is the status of that?
Yeah, so thanks, Marla. So that's one of the reasons why, even if you're fully vaccinated, if you're in public, or if you visit a household where there's somebody who's at risk for severe reaction, you still need to mask and physically distance. So for the available vaccines right now, they're all really good. They're all excellent at preventing severe complications and death. And, you know, one of the reasons for getting the vaccine is because you can virtually, or closely as possible, eliminate your chance of dying from the vaccine. I mean, I'm sorry, dying of COVID, not dying from the vaccine. Excuse me on that one. Dying of COVID-19. The issue and the question is, do they prevent infections? And none of the vaccines, I'd point out, are 100% effective. We have had some evidence of a vaccine breakthrough, both with the Pfizer vaccine, actually more of the Pfizer vaccine than the Moderna vaccine. But one of the reasons for that is that the Pfizer vaccine has been around longer than the Moderna vaccine. But once again, vaccine breakthrough is, and the numbers are really small, and I can get you that they're minuscule, but vaccine breakthrough is somebody who's fully vaccinated 14 days after their second dose and develops an infection as a positive test. So I think there may be some more evidence, you know, as we get more experience with the vaccines over time, both, you know, all three of them, people will be able to get an idea of, you know, how much they prevent infection. I think there's evidence that they do, all of them prevent infection, but to what degree, you know, I don't have the answer for that. And there may be better news about the Pfizer vaccine, but I've also got to point out, there's still a lot of unknowns. I mean, we know that the vaccines provide stronger and more long-lasting immunity than the actual natural infection. So that's why people with natural infection are still advised to get the vaccine. We don't know, and this is when I, you know, I was talking about herd immunity, the disease, the virus has been around for maybe a year and a half, and actually, Lawrence just put something in the chat that the UCLA study shows a vaccine breakthrough is a 0.05%, which is really low, but it's not zero. We don't know for sure how long the vaccines will provide protection for, and it could very well be that people will need a booster over time. So when you say that, you know, when we say, like, you know, the Pfizer vaccine prevents infection, there may be more evidence around that, but for how long and whether you will eventually need another booster, we don't know that yet. So, and also, you know, now that we have variants emerging, some of them we may see, you know, again, we're in a race against the virus. Like, for example, the South African variants, for example, some of them may be some slightly more resistant to the protection from the vaccine. So there is some evidence, you know, we know that the vaccines do prevent, you know, you're less likely to get infected as well as you're less likely to have severe reaction or death, but it's not 100%. Another long-winded answer to your question.
Appreciate the answer. Thank
and
you.
Lawrence put in the chat a vaccine breakthrough from the study at usually asymptomatic, so people are infected at 0.05%. And then also Lawrence put in the chat about, I haven't seen this book, Think Again, a good discussion about a vaccine whisperer and how he achieved so much, vaccine whisperer and how he achieved so much success. So I'm going to have to get that book on our reading list. So Dr. Neville has had some microphone problems, but he put a lot of really good information in the chat box.
Yeah, very good.
Fortunately, he agrees with me, so that makes me feel a lot better.
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Neville. Hopefully he can hear us. Sounds like he can. Any other questions? Well, we have our experts here. Well, I think maybe we've asked all the questions we have right now. So thank you to the team for bringing that information to us and taking time to allow us to ask questions. And so yeah, then I think what we'll do is move on to the executive committee portion of the meeting and also council member updates.
Marla,
yes?
Before I interrupt, do you want to hear about House Bill 1152?
Oh, sorry. Take it away.
So, for those of you who may not recall, and I'll try to be as succinct as possible, the governor dropped House Bill 1152 back in December without notifying or involving local public health officials. So, we've been advocating for funding for foundational public health services. You've all been helpful with that. We all, you know, you heard Jeff earlier. Public health is underfunded, and we got a small amount a couple of session ago of $22 million a biennium, but we've been asking, we need a lot more than that to adequately fund the public health system in the state. And, you know, what we've had to deal with around COVID-19 is just an example about that. And so we've been advocating for foundational public health services, but at the same time, in the midst of the pandemic, we're all really busy. This bill got dropped in the legislature that would reorganize or really change the state public health system. So Washington State is a home rule state in which local communities are the local, you know, are the public health jurisdictions, and they have the statutory authority of the state in terms of public health interventions and things we do to protect our communities. And there are different types of local health jurisdictions in the state. Some are county health departments, some are districts, some are city county health departments. What this bill would have done, it would have done a number of things. One is it would have changed the composition of local boards of health. Right now, local boards of health are made up of the county elected officials by statute determine how the boards of health are constituted. And they can create districts if they want. They can have people who are non-elected members of the Board of Health. It's up to the county elected officials. We in Clark County are a county health department, and our Board of Health is made up of the county elected officials. Spokane, for example, was not a county health department. It was a district, and it had electeds from around the region, both a county as well as city, and then non-electeds on it. Clark County used to be part of the Southwest Washington Health District, and that included Klickitat, Skamania, and Clark County. And at that time, the health district had not only elected officials from the three counties, but also had representatives from, I believe, cities as well as non-elected members on the district board of health. I think it was back in 2003, the commissioners of the three counties, as the statute allowed, decided to form their own county health departments, and that's how we ended up with Clark County being a county health department. But to maintain the input that had been in the district from non-elected members as well, you know, other community representatives, the county back in, I think it was around 2003, created the Public Health Advisory Council, and that'll be relevant in a minute when I get to what happened with 1152. So one of the things that the governor's bill would have done, or the bill that he dropped, would have actually changed the composition of local boards of health and included non-elected representatives, I think would be equal to the number of elected members that would be appointed by the elected members. The other thing that the bill, I'm just going to mention a couple of the main parts of the bill. The other thing the bill would do, and the reason for this bill ostensibly was to get the politics out of public health after the Spokane health officer was fired. But I point out that he was fired by a district, not by a county. But anyway, that's another long story. But the bill would have created regional districts. This bill has gone through many amendments and changes. Regional public health, I'm trying to remember, comprehensive health districts around the state. There were nine of them originally that would have been districts with state employees that were engaged in public health activities. That got changed. Eventually, the last iteration of the bill had four of these districts. They're not districts anymore. They were centers for shared services, two on the east side and two on the west side, and also had an administrator and a health officer, a regional health officer, who were state employees. So that was in the bill. A number of us in Wasafa, my local colleagues, had concerns about that because it seemed to us like it created another layer of bureaucracy, of state bureaucracy, that really didn't, it wasn't even clear. Well, we made it clear in one of the changes in the bill that the local health authority didn't go away, but it was not really clear to us what these centers would do. And the other point about them is that they were some of the foundational public health services funding we were going to get was going to go to build these centers up. So first it was after $30 million of biennium, 65% of the funding would go to these centers. Then they made it $60 million, after $60 million biennium, then 65% of it would go to these centers. And so if we got 100 or 150 million, which is what we're likely to get for the public health system, a significant chunk of that after the first 60 million would go to these regional centers. So that was in there as well. Then there was this, the Foundational Public Health Services Steering Committee still exists. That was going to make recommendations over time in terms of what the system should look at. And then there was this Public Health Advisory Board that the state would create that had a large number of members, including representatives of physicians, nursing associations, hospital associations, other community groups. And I think it had one local health official on it, which was to evaluate, you know, what was going on with public health. So I'll cut to the chase here. There's been a number of changes in the bill, and I'm pleased to say after the strikers that, you know, the bill that finally emerged, basically those regional, whatever you want to call them, four centers no longer exist. They're gone. And where FAC comes in is that the Clark County will get an exception to having a remade Board of Health precisely because we have FAC. So we were able to share the FAC bylaws with the folks that are putting this bill together. And counties like ours that have a FAC get an exception to the requirement about board composition, although our counselors could decide at any time if they want to change the board composition, but they're not required to because we have the FAC. So there's no longer these regional services. We have FAC, so we're an exception to changing things that way. And the Public Health Advisory Board now has more, instead of having one local health official on it, there'll actually be two from the east side of the mountains and two from the west side of the state, one small county and one large county in each one, so there'll be more public health representation on it. That was the final bill that passed. I'm ecstatic that these regional centers are not there anymore. So, and, you know, the concern was we're making all these changes in the middle of a pandemic when most of us who would provide input into this, local public health officials, have been busy killing ourselves over the pandemic and haven't, you know, the question is, why do this now? Now we'll have time for the Foundational Public Health Services Steering Committee to actually take a look at the system, figure out what works and what doesn't work, and any changes that we need to make. So that, you know, you're hearing my bias on this, but I thought it was all in all, you know, a really positive outcome. And actually, the process matters as much as the outcome. And I wish we had a better process through this. But I'm looking forward to the evaluation and the work of the FPHS Steering Committee and our after action report from COVID-19 and, you know, what we can learn in the next year or two about, you know, how we strengthen our public health system. And I'm also pleased that the Foundational Public Health Services money, instead of going to these regional services, will actually go to county jurisdictions. I also want to point out that we're already doing shared services in Southwest Washington. We provide health officer services now to six counties, and we've got the Nurse Family Partnership services that we're providing for CALID. So, and we're working together as an IMT, incident management team, around the COVID-19 response. So that's where House Bill 1152 is. I wanted to share that with all of you. And I'm not barking up the wrong tree, I hope.
Well, that, I'm so glad to hear that, because I actually heard about this a while ago, and as I was trying to follow the trail of tears, I was pretty worried about it. I'm very relieved to hear how it has evolved and to what sounds like a better place.
Yeah, and I'd point out that, you know, if you have a centralized state system, that doesn't take the politics out of public health, because you got, you know, it centralizes it with the governor versus, you know, politics in counties. I mean, it that reasoning was, I question that reasoning on that.
Questions from the group for
Mark Collier. I have a comment. I'm glad it went the way it did. Just from, I've been involved with health districts and local health department and know the history and everything. And also we have a relationship with the Washington State Department of Health, and having these like four public health district centers, I think that'd be just another layer of bureaucracy that would be ridiculous. It cost money. I just can't believe they even came up with such a proposal from past history in the state.
Yeah, and the other point we, thanks Mark, the other point we made out is that this work is built on relationships. I mean, and that a regional center does not have the kind of relationships you have at the county, you know, at the county level, and that's how the work gets done.
Other questions? When I first looked at the bill, I just thought there is so much going on in this bill. You know, it's just, it was just kind of amazing. So I'm glad that it has evolved to where it is right now. It's good news. So if there are no more questions, maybe we'll shift gears. Thank you again for catching my skipping over. I'm having a little trouble with my eyesight. That's why I keep putting my, got new prescriptions, so I keep putting my glasses off and on. And the executive committee and council member updates, I believe that every member of the Public Health Advisory Council received an email from Gary Albrecht from Clark County, and they're forming, or they're doing some major work seeking input from FACT community member. They'd like a representative from FACT in some of their transportation planning, because we do have some common interests. So, but the way I understand, and we didn't really have time for him to come and speak with us, and I don't, it's probably be a while before we would be able to do that. So the way, my understanding is the way we want to address this is if there are individual members on the FACT committee that are interested in more information, to go respond to Gary Albrecht directly and see what, you know, more information you make up from that. And I don't know if anybody on the committee, on our council, has an interest in participating, but that would be the place to start. And Roxanne or Alan, do you have anything to add? It sounded like that's where we were going to leave it for now. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
All right then. And so our next meeting is going to be June 8th, format to be determined. But before we close, we still have time to see if anyone on the council has anything to bring to the group and anything to share, a question to ask, or just an update to provide. Anything you've heard that as a representative of this health department that you are hearing in the community that needs to be addressed? That's very quiet. I guess not. Okay. Well, then I think I'll get ready to close the meeting, but I do want to say thank you again, especially to our council member, Karen Bowerman. Thank you so much for joining us, and to the guests that visited with us today, and to all of you who made time on such a beautiful day to do this important work that we are privileged to do for the public health services of our community. And so with that, I'll ask if someone would like to move that we would adjourn. And a second, please.
I move to adjourn.
Thank you.
Okay, we've had a motion and a second, and all in favor, say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Hearing none, the meeting will be adjourned. Have a wonderful evening, all.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Marla.
Thank you, Marla.
My pleasure.